We're actually in Romans 2. Last week, because we were away about a month, I went ahead and reoriented us in Romans, and we looked there, and we brought up a very important thing that I didn't really stress before, and that's the important thing we need to grasp now before we go into Romans 3, that Romans isn't just about our salvation. It's not just about human redemption. It's not God procuring human redemption. There's something much, much, much more important than that. As important that is, there's something even more important than that going on in Romans. And we looked at that last week, and we brought that out, and we noted that the bigger thing going on in Romans is the manifestation of God's glory. Let's just look at a couple of things. Look at chapter 1, verse 5. Chapter 1, verse 5, and let's see this glory theme go through here. Now, he's just announcing to the, not even the world, but the universe, we're on display before the angels. Our position, as Ephesians delineates, is seated in the heavenlies. And God is announcing through Paul that he has introduced a new and unique apostle, the Apostle Paul. He's introduced a new and unique apostleship. He's introduced a new and unique message of grace. And he's introduced a new and unique program, all in those first five verses there. And then you go over to Ephesians, and he announces that he's begun a new and unique purpose in reestablishing his glory in the heavenlies. And here he comes through all that. If you follow mainline religion and things like that, you'd think that he's going to come along here and say he's doing all these things for man's salvation, for man's redemption. But that's not what it says here. Look at verse 5. He's gone through this, a new and unique apostle, new and unique apostle, new and unique message, new and unique program to bless the Gentiles apart from Israel. And then in verse 5, he says, by whom we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all names. For human salvation? No, it says, for his name. The primary thing God is doing at the beginning of Romans is saying he's doing all this, he's raised up this new and distinct apostle and apostleship for the glory of his name. That's the primary purpose. That's the most significant thing. And as we go into Romans 3, that's going to become critically important. The main purpose of Romans, you know, sometimes even grace teachers will call this the handbook of our salvation. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It is certainly the handbook of our salvation. But if you think that's all it is, then you're missing the primary purpose of Romans is to manifest the glory of God. And if not one person got saved, what he accomplished through his son on that cross still displays his glory infinitely. If not one person was saved, it wouldn't diminish that glory one fraction of an iota. There's something bigger going on in Romans than our salvation, and that's the manifestation of the glory of God. And these first three chapters are centering on that. And of course, there's the flip side to that. If the reason God has raised up the Apostle Paul and given him a distinct apostleship is for his namesake, for the glory of his name, well, the flip side of that is if you discard Paul's distinct apostleship, if you throw away Paul's distinctive message, if you don't think there's anything distinctive about what God's doing through Paul, then you're throwing away God's glory, because that's what he's doing through the apostleship of Paul today. He's raised up this apostle for his namesake. Then in verse 16, he says, and it's the power of God unto salvation to all who believe, and our salvation comes in there. But at the very beginning, the reason God gives for raising up Paul is for his namesake. And name in ancient Israel, you know, it had to do with everything that's true of somebody. Their name meant everything. And we could use the word glory, all that's true about something. And he's raised up Paul and given him a distinct apostleship to proclaim all that's true about him. And then flip over to chapter 2. But just to kind of get this glory concept in line, or despises, this is Romans 2:4, or despisest thou the riches of his goodness and forbearance and longsuffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads thee to repentance. And we saw that whenever Paul talks about and explains his distinct apostleship, whether it be in Romans 9, 10, 11, whether it be over in Ephesians and Corinthians, wherever he does it, almost always he puts this riches concept in place. It's the riches of his goodness, the riches of his forbearance, the riches of his long-suffering, the riches of his grace, the riches of his mercy, the riches of his power. When he talks about the mystery, it's the riches of God's wisdom and knowledge, and it's the riches for us that God's dispensing. What God is doing today is dispensing the riches of his goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering. If we put together those three words and tagged on grace and mercy, you know what you could probably call that? You say the riches of his glory. What God is doing today is dispensing, through Paul's apostrophe, is dispensing the riches of his glory. And then we can look at the flip side of that. To despise is the word here in verse 4, despise. Now, to us, you know, despise is kind of like violently attack. You know, when I think of despise, I think of something really strong. But the Greek, underlying Greek word, is just has the idea of value, not valuing something. Thinking something doesn't apply to you. Thinking it has no value for you. And that fits in this whole argument, because what's he talking? He's dispensing his riches. And if you despise Paul's apostleship, if you despise the way God's dispensing his riches, you despise the riches of God. And then he goes in verses 5 and 6, and he says, and if you despise the riches of God, the only thing you're going to get rich in is wrath under the day of wrath. If you despise God's treasures, he's making the riches of God's treasures he's making available now through the apostleship of Paul, the only thing you're treasuring up is wrath under the day of wrath. If we despise Paul's apostleship, the flip side of that is we're despising the goodness of God. You know, most of the teachers and most of the Bible teachers out there, at their very best, are biblically sound in the salvation message and things that they've at least embraced Paul's gospel, salvation by grace through faith. But almost virtually everyone else has discarded Paul's distinctive ministry. And when you do that, you're just off on the wrong foot to very begin with. You're despising what God's doing today through that apostleship. Now look over at chapter 3, verse 3. And this is just that glory concept again. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. Yea, let God be true and every man a liar, as it is written, that thou might be justified in thy sayings and might overcome when thou art judged. But if our unrighteousness commends the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous, who takes vengeance? Now look down at verse 7. For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I judged as a sinner? And what he's going to drive home is just that glory concept. In chapter 1, he says the very purpose for bringing Paul and his apostleship on the scene was for his namesake, for the glory of his name. In chapter 2, he says to despise what he's doing through the apostleship is to despise the riches of his glory he's dispensing through that apostleship. And now, in Romans 3, he's going to answer those critics once and for all who they're saying the very opposite of what God and Paul say. They're coming up to him and say, no, Paul, if what you're saying is true, if your apostleship is true, then God is unfaithful, God is unrighteous, God is untruthful. It just comes through and carries through that glory theme again, and he's going to answer that until we reach verse 25 and 26. Look at verse 26 as long as we're over in chapter 3. Verse 26, to declare, I say, at this time, his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of him which believes in Jesus. I'm driving home this point is usually people go to Romans 3:21 and say, now finally we're in the important part and he's going to tell us how man is saved. Well, he does tell us that in here, but there's something even more important. What he's doing in chapter 3 is, yes, he's providing salvation for man, explaining salvation to humanity, but what he's doing that's even more important than that is he's explaining the glory of God. He's explaining how God can maintain his righteousness while justifying wrong sinners. How can God be just and the justifier? And these enemies of Paul's, these critics of Paul, said, if what you're saying is true, then God is unjust, God is unrighteous, God is unfaithful, God is untruthful. And what he's doing there is he's explaining how God can remain glorious, how God can maintain his glory while justifying sinners. And in the process, he tells us he covers our salvation, but the primary purpose of chapter 3 is making known the glory of God. And if we despise what God's doing through the apostleship of Paul, if we throw away that distinct apostleship, if we throw it away, then the flip side of that is we're throwing away God's glory, we're throwing away God's name, we're throwing away the riches of his goodness, because that's what he's doing now through the apostleship of Paul. Look up at the heavens, and I hope all of you, when you look up into the heavens, you don't see a beautiful blue sky with just a couple clouds scattering through. Hopefully you see the gates of heaven, and you see the waves of God's wrath almost sloshing off past the wall. And God standing there saying, I'm holding my wrath and judgment back a little while longer so that everybody has an opportunity to be saved based on the glory of his name. That reveals something glorious about our God. The fact he's doing that. The fact he's doing that. And you know, a lot of times when I talk to people about this, they'll say, oh, you're too bold, you're too confident. And probably they mean self-confident. But you know, 20 years ago, as I began to understand this, I'd kind of sugarcoat it, and I'd kind of cover it with whitewash, and I'd kind of figure a way. Well, you know, I don't do that anymore. I'm in my 50s. I'm getting old. So I just cut right to the chase now, and I speak boldly. And what they don't realize is when they say I speak boldly, I just take it as an answer to prayer. Look over to Ephesians 6. And this is what I pray every morning. I'm not saying I do it very well, but this is what I pray every morning. Look at the end of Ephesians 6, verse 18. Ephesians 6, verse 18. Paul's in prison. Paul's locked away, and he's going to give them a prayer request. Now think, imagine you're in prison. You're not doing very well physically. You got all kinds of problems. And I bet if we went up and down each aisle here, each row, we could probably put out a list of a couple hundred things we'd ask the Ephesians to pray for. But let's look at what Paul wanted them to pray on behalf of him. Romans 6, verse 18, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto all perseverance and supplication for the saints, and for me, that utterance may be given unto me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in bonds, that therein I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. We need to speak boldly. You know, people don't get it until you speak boldly. And we need to speak boldly about these things. If we don't speak boldly, if I don't speak boldly about this, well, who is? If Peter, Pastor Peter, were to not stop talking boldly about this, well, who is? If this assembly stops talking boldly about, well, who is? Mainline religious Christianity? The denominations? Who's going to speak boldly about this? And I think it's important for us to realize that we have this great privilege whereby God is making us participants in what he's doing. And one of the main things we need to do is speak this thing boldly. You know, I talked about the Pauliceans. They go back 1,000, 1,500 years, and they spoke boldly. And you know, they lived over in Asia Minor where Paul's ministry started. They were so persecuted there, killed and persecuted in other ways. They were driven west, and they went west, and they were still persecuted there. And when they had a meeting, they'd have to go up into the mountains in the middle of the night. And you know when they'd do it? They'd do it when the weather was really bad, because then they would think, no, there'd be less chance someone would see them. And they go up, and you know, they didn't have a Jeep or an SUV. They went up on maybe a donkey, probably more likely by their own feet, and they went up in the caves in the middle of the night to worship like we're worshiping here today. Now, one day, someone may find a textbook written by a Polynesian, and maybe we'll disagree with everything in it. But based on what we know from what the enemy said, They're someone who embraced Paul's apostleship message and ministry. And they went up in the caves and they did that. And you know, if they got caught, you know what happened? You know, the worst thing that happened to us going to church this morning is we might get pulled over for speeding, right? Well, they, if they got caught, they were strung on a rope and wrapped around a tree and burnt at the stake. And every bit of their writings was destroyed. That's why we don't know anything about them except what their enemies say. And they were tried to be wiped out, but you know what they did? Even non-dispensational scholars and things like that, they come and they admit that the Pauliceans were the spark that set off the Reformation. And who knows? We need to speak boldly. And I know it's a Sunday morning. I don't want to be too heavy on a Sunday morning, but the spotlight of history is on us now. Are we going to speak boldly or not? And that's the question. And are we going to continue to do that? The spotlight of history is shining on us now, just like it did them then, maybe 1,000 years ago. I mean, 1,000 years from now, should the Lord tarry, maybe somebody will be being persecuted and they'll be thankful for some witness we may have contributed to way back down here. And so not to get too heavy on a Sunday morning, but, you know, this isn't just come and sing songs and stuff like that. This is something where God is inviting us to participate in things of eternal and everlasting value. And one of those things is to speak boldly about that. And so, you know, that could change your whole outlook on how you deal with it, like evangelism. Just think of evangelism. Where do we get, when we want a book on evangelism, we go to the bookstore, right? And who usually writes those books? People who have thrown away the distinct apostleship of Paul. So what do they say is the most important thing about evangelism? Well, it's that other person's salvation. That's the main thing. You want to just get right in and talk to him about his salvation. But you know, when you rightly divide, when you recognize Paul's distinctive teaching, when you recognize and follow the way God has designed it in Romans, you don't start there. You start in the beginning of Romans 1, and you show them that there's something bigger than their salvation, and that's the glory of God. I used to do what those people said, and you'd go in and you start talking about how sinful people are, and you know, maybe some of you are much better at that than I am, but most of the time when I did that, I didn't even see which way they went. They left so fast. But now what I do is I start talking to them about the new program God has brought in through the Apostle Paul. And I tell them this new program, and I tell them about all the glory it reveals of God and how it brings out God's glory. And I say, and the best thing, news of part of that is that it displays his glory and they can be participants in it. God is inviting them to participate in it. God's inviting us to participate in it. And then, you know what sometimes they say? Actually, quite a lot of times they say, well, what's that? And then you can kind of go on, and you can go on. And, of course, eventually you're going to get, well, how do I get involved in that? And then you can, they're much more receptive to the gospel message in the sense of their sin and needing redemption and salvation. So I just throw that out as one thing to think about. And talk to them, talk to people about this new program God's introduced to Paul, especially for the Gentiles, which are them most of the time. And just see if you don't get a little reaction than trying to hit them up with their sin and they beeline it out of there as fast as they can. So all that was extra. That wasn't even in my notes. So we're going to go ahead and pick up where we are in the notes here. So Romans chapter 2, and we're reoriented in Romans, and we're kind of picking up there. We're left off at verse 25. So we're going to head down that way. Let's just remember where we've come. Romans 2 is divided into two sections. The first half is headed up by the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. Now, you know, some people say they're talking about Gentile moralists. Well, I'm sure they are talking about Gentile moralists. He is talking about Gentile moralists. But when I hear inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, he's talking to Gentile moralists, but I think he's talking to the whole world. O man, whosoever you are. Whoever you are. And then he's going to go in and he's going to tell what this inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, is doing. And the main purpose of Romans 2 is to ask the question that everyone here should be asking and everyone in the whole world should be asking, the oh man whosoever you are, is what are you going to do during the time when God is dispensing the riches of his goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering? Are you going to misuse and abuse it like the inexcusable oh man whosoever you are? What does he do? He presumes a privileged position before God based on relative human righteousness that he thinks makes him superior to others and at the same time allows him to escape the judgment of God. And Paul points out the problem with that is that that man is doing the same things. The things he's condemning in the people around him that he thinks he's better, he's doing the same things. And he's saying, if you think that's a recipe for escaping God's judgment, you're wrong. It's not. It's just a way to despise what God is doing now. And remember, holding back his wrath and judgment a little while longer. He's being long-suffering. He's holding it back. It's sloshing over the levee walls, but he's holding it back. And how are you going to use the time when God is being long-suffering? Are you going to use it the way the inexcusable old man whosoever you are? Or are you going to use it rightly, which Paul's going to explain a little bit later? Yeah, look it down at verse 16, because this is going to be a pivotal verse as we go on. Chapter 2, verse 16, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men. See, that's a principle here. That he's not going to look at the externals, and this is going to carry all the way through to the end of the chapter. He's looking at the hidden things, the secret things. And where are the hidden things? They're in the heart. He's going to look at the heart. And if you end up standing before him based on your own works, or based on what you say, he's not going to listen to what you say. He's going to look at the condition of your heart. Is it hard and unrepentant? If you think you're going to be able to wheel up your wagon of works and you're going to call them good and you want him to agree with that, well, then you need to know that if they weren't produced in the factory powered by God on an assembly line, cleansed with the blood of Christ, sanctified by the Spirit, and the company policy isn't motivated by the love of God at the cross of Christ, and it's not powered by God working in and through the people there, that 24/7 pursuing and seeking after glory, honor, immortality, incorruptibility, and peace, in other words, Christ, then it came off the other assembly line. It came off the assembly line and a factory of sin and death, powered by sin, contaminated with death, and everything that comes off that assembly line is condemned unto destruction. Just like Blue Bunny ice cream. You know, the health department, they didn't regather every single quart of ice cream and figure out which ones were good or bad or anything. They didn't care about the ice cream. They didn't care. There were millions of people that ate Blue Bunny ice cream during that Listeria scare, and you know, only two handfuls got sick and four or five of them died. So if you were to ask most of them, most of those people would say it was good ice cream. But the health department, and they didn't look at the ice cream, they didn't look at the works, they looked at the work process. They looked at where that ice cream came from. And if it came out of a plant that was contaminated with Listeria, all the ice cream was condemned and sent for destruction. There's nothing else you could do with it. All the schools had to destroy it. All the churches had to destroy it. Everybody had to destroy it. And that's what he's driving. God looks at the hidden things. He's not going to look at the works that you may call good and your neighbor may call good and the world may call good. He's going to look at the work process that produced it. And if it came off a contaminated line, then it's not a good work. It's a bad work. And all it can be is for anguish and tribulation, wrath and judgment. And he brings the inexcusable old man who's here right in there, and that last appeal they can make is based on the law. What's the Gentile going to say about the law? You didn't give me the law, so I didn't know any better. And what's the Jew going to say about the law? The Jew's going to say, you gave me the law, so you can't judge me. And God's going to say, none of those work, none of those excuses. And he ends the chapter very quickly, ends this first half of the chapter very quickly by telling why the Gentile who doesn't have the law is condemned and perished. And the Gentile who doesn't have the law is condemned and perished because he has that basic moral compass that becomes a law unto itself. And once you have a law, the law goes to work. And whenever I ask anyone, this is kind of like my trick question for people, whenever I set people up and ask them this question, they always say it produces righteousness. But you know, that's not what God and Paul say. God and Paul say in Romans 4, the law worketh wrath. If you're using the law properly, it's not going to alleviate guilt and shame and all that. It's going to produce wrath, guilt, and shame. That law goes to work producing guilt and shame and condemnation and wrath and judgment. And that clicks in mode the conscience, and it bears witness. Yeah, you really did something wrong. And that sets in motion the two ways we can think, right? We either are going to accept the verdict and acknowledge our guilt and shame, or that we did something wrong, or what's more typical? We try to alleviate the guilt and shame by coming up with excuses, by excusing what we've done. And it doesn't matter. Either way, you're going to land in Romans 2, verse 16, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men. You're going to land right there, and you're already going to be self-condemned. You're already self-condemned, and when you get in God's judgment, you're not going to fare any better before Him. Because it's going to be by Jesus Christ according to my gospel, Paul's gospel. Now, why Paul's gospel? Is it because Paul's anything? Paul's nothing. Paul's a persecutor, was a persecutor of the believing remnant and an enemy of Christ and God. Paul's nothing. But we learned in 2 Corinthians 3, God made Paul into something. If you end up standing before God based on your own personal works and righteousness, what's the only thing He's going to want to know? The only question He's going to ask is, what did you do with Paul's gospel? And why? Because God reveals through Paul's gospel the person and work of Christ on the cross. If you think you're going to be able to stand there before God based on your own person and works while having despised the person and work of Christ, well, Paul's giving a little heads up here. He's like, it's not going to work. It's not going to end well for you. And then you throw in the fact the person and work you've been despising, Christ, He's the one that's going to be judged. And you don't have any hope there. If you think you're going to be able to stand before Him based on your own righteousnesses while having despised the righteousness of God Himself revealed in Paul's gospel, well, that's the second strike against you. It's hopeless. You're not going to win that battle. And He brings the whole world now together guilty before Him, inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, who despises the riches of God's goodness by belittling or not thinking Paul's apostleship, message, ministry, and gospel applies to him. Then the last half of the chapter, now we've already dealt with all humanity, but there's one group in humanity who might just think they're an exception to the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. They have their own revelation, a true revelation from God, and maybe some of them might conclude they don't need Paul's revelation. And that's the Jew. Behold, thou art called a Jew. And he now, in the last half of Romans 2, drives home the point that now the Jew needs Paul, what God is doing through Paul's apostleship, as much as the Gentiles. The inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, of verse 1, becomes in verse 17, behold, you call a Jew. And he shows that the Jew does exactly the same thing that the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, did at the beginning of chapter 2. He presumes a privileged position before God based on relative human law righteousness that makes him superior to others and allows him to escape God's wrath. And Paul drives home the you who teach the law, do you do the law? See, the point is, they're doing the same things they taught against, just like the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. And so he brings the Jews in here now, and he says, you're not an exception to the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, worthy of God's judgment and condemnation and judgment. You're an example of the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, worthy of God's condemnation and judgment. And he leads them through that, and he takes them first back to Moses at that golden calf incident, and he takes them back to Nathan when Nathan confronts David about the David and Bathsheba incidents. And he brings to mind why they're in exile, because they broke the law, and he points them to that future when the believing remnant and when they're restored as a nation. And he takes all that, and he says, now, what the Jews needed to do was not respond to the long-suffering of God the way the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, responded. See, we're back to this question. How are we going to respond to the time when God's being long-suffering? Are we going to respond the way the inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, that abuses it? Or are we going to respond properly? And Paul shows these Jews the right way to respond to God's the time when God's being long-suffering. And he goes back to Moses and that golden calf incident. And the important point here to get is, did Moses, during the long-suffering of God, did Moses say, well, God, you gave us the law, so you can't judge us, like some Jews were saying in Paul's day. We automatically escape your judgment. No, Moses didn't say that. Did David say, well, yeah, it's true, God, I committed adultery and murdered someone, but you know, I still haven't done the really, I didn't commit idolatry. So, you know, I'm still not as bad as the Gentiles, so I ought to be good enough for you. Is that how he put up an argument with God? Did he minimize his sin? It's not any of those things. The right way to use the time when God's being long-suffering is they had to find a way apart from the law. They had to find a way without the law to relate to God, and they did that. Moses and David did that by falling on the grace that God made available to them. For Moses and Israel is the grace resident in that Jehovah name. And then I always think it's humorous, because it sounds to me when I read that passage, Moses mainly appeals to the grace resident in that Jehovah name, and then he's a little worried that might not be enough, so he throws in the grace resident in that Abrahamic covenant. And he kind of says, just in case that's not enough, I'm going to kick it up a notch. And David, he had those same sources of grace, but what did Psalm 51 tell us? He fell primarily on the grace resident in God's promise to him, that Davidic covenant that we looked at pretty in-depthly. And then, when you look at that, the believing remnant in the future, when they're going into the kingdom and God restores the nation, what is the restored nation going to do? They're going to plead with God to relate to them on the basis of grace. Receive us graciously. They're going to fall on the grace resident in that new covenant for Israel in the future. And Paul's point here is the Jews of his day needed to do what Moses and David and that restored nation was going to do in the future. To do what the inexcusable old man, whosoever you are, is doing is to abuse the time when God's being long-suffering. To use it properly, they needed to find a way apart from the law. They needed to relate to God without the law. They needed to fall on the grace God's made available to him. And starting in Romans 3:21, guess what, Paul, how he begins that section? But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God is being revealed. Even the righteousness of God, which is in Christ Jesus, which is by faith of Christ Jesus, unto all and upon all them that believe. He's going to take the Jews of his day and show them how they can relate to God apart from the law and how they can fall on the grace resident in the person and work of the Lord Jesus Christ. And let's pick it up now and we'll finish off the chapter. Romans 2, verse 24. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written. Now, we can't pick it up here real carefully, but a Jew who knew their scriptures would. And what he's doing here, he takes a little blurb out of Ezekiel, and we saw look that up as Ezekiel 36, and he takes a little bit out of Isaiah 52, and in Romans 2:24, he sticks them together. And we looked at why Paul would take a little phrase from Ezekiel 36 and a phrase from Isaiah 52, that name of the Lord and blaspheming the Lord among the Gentiles, and he sticks them together in Romans 2:24, and the question is why? And I think this is the most amazing thing in the whole chapter. And you'd probably be surprised because I think there's so many amazing things in this chapter. But what he does here, he takes these Jews of his day, takes them back to Ezekiel 36. And you know, do you remember what happened in Ezekiel 36? Ezekiel prophesies about the cleansing ministry for Israel. Now you say, well, okay, what's that got to do with this? The cleansing program for Israel began with the ministry of John the Baptist and his water baptism. There's going to be all kinds of cleansings. There's going to be the water baptism cleansing. There's going to be a cleansing with blood at the cross. There's going to be a cleansing of fire in the future, of judgment and fire in the future. Christ's whole earthly program was cleansing. What did he do when he came on the scene? What did he do when he went in the temple? He cleansed the temple. What did he do when he arrived on the scene and when he sent out the 12? What did he tell them to do? Cast out demons and heal the sick. He's cleansing the land. What did he do with the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes and all those things? He was cleansing Israel's doctrine. Remember, they had buried the law under the traditions of men. And Jesus comes on the scene and he's like, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that. And he pulls out the pure pearl of the law and starts teaching that to them. He cleansed their doctrine. He cleansed the temples. He's cleansing the land. He's going to, in this whole brackets in the cleansing of sin and Israel's prophetic cleansing program. Now, keep that in mind because Paul takes them back to Ezekiel 36. They're prophesied the beginning of this cleansing program, the beginning of Israel's cleansing program. Then he takes us in the next phrase to Isaiah 52 and 53. And hopefully we all know what's in Isaiah 52 and 53, that amazing prophetic account of the suffering, death, and resurrection of Israel's Messiah, God's servant, the Lord Jesus Christ. And he brings them in there. Who has believed our report? Who is Isaiah referring? Who is Isaiah prophesying about there? The Messiah is going to come and he's going to be rejected by his own people. Now keep this in mind. So now we've gone from Ezekiel 36 with the beginning of the plunging program that began with John the Baptist at the beginning of Christ's earthly ministry, and now we're at the end of Christ's earthly ministry at the suffering, death, and resurrection on the cross. And we're at a suffering, death, and resurrection, and that kind of encapsulates Christ's whole earthly ministry. He takes him to the beginning and takes him to the end and puts it together. And what he's saying is here to the Jews of his day, beginning with the Israel's leaders in Jerusalem and Israel's leaders throughout Israel and all those out in the world who are following their lead, the Jews of his day who are doing that, he brings them right into the middle of Jesus' earthly ministry, and he tells them, you're the ones Isaiah and Ezekiel were talking about. They're the ones who needed to be cleansed. They're the ones who rejected Messiah. He brings them, I think amazingly, he brings the Jews of his day and he says, you're the ones Ezekiel and Isaiah were prophesying about. You're the ones they were talking about would reject the Messiah. If you're following the leaders out of Israel and Jerusalem and Israel, then you're a part of that. And you're the ones Isaiah and Ezekiel were talking about. And he brings the Jews of his day and drives home that point that they're the ones that those prophets were talking about. If anyone needed to find a way apart from the law by falling on the grace of God, the grace God made available to them, it was the Jews of Paul's day. You know, Israel and David and the remnant and everyone, they may have broken the law. But you know, the Jews of his day not only broke the law, they killed the lawgiver. If anyone needed what God is doing through Paul's apostleship, it was the Jews of his day. And now let's look at verse 25. For circumcision verily profits if you keep the law. But if thou be a breaker of the law, which he's just proven, thy circumcision is made uncircumcision. And therefore, if the uncircumcision keep the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted for circumcision? And shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, if it fulfill the law, judge thee, who by the letter and circumcision do transgress the law. Now, it's kind of a convoluted passage, but his main point here is saying is that the external circumcision isn't going to help you if you break the law, and he's just shown they broke the law. The external circumcision was supposed to be a symbol, a token of something that was true in their heart. And if they're rebelling against the law, if they're lawbreakers, then it's a heart issue again. And their uncircumcision is made by God to be, or their circumcision is made uncircumcision. Verse 26, therefore, if the uncircumcision keep the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted for circumcision? And now he's driving home this point. Let's not get sidetracked. He's not saying here that there's some Gentiles that are better than the Jews. He's not saying all or some Gentiles are better than Jews. That's not his point. The whole point of this passage is he's not raising up the Gentiles and make them sound better than the Jews. What he's doing here is he's taking the Jews and making them understand that they're no better than the Gentiles. And the key word in this, therefore, if the uncircumcision, that's a conditional, that's a hypothetical thing. He's not saying any Gentile's ever done this or ever will do it. He's saying, therefore, if he's giving them a logic, a thought experiment. He says, don't you think that if keeping the law is the key thing, if you had a Gentile who is externally not circumcised, but he was able to keep the righteous requirements of the law, wouldn't God reckon that for circumcision? And he's trying to drive home to this Jew, if that can happen to a Gentile, then for the Jew, his circumcision can be reckoned for uncircumcision. See, the external sign isn't what matters, it's what's going on the inside. It doesn't matter, having the external law and external circumcision only is a benefit if you keep the law. But the Jews were law breakers. And shall not, verse 27, and shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, if, it's not saying anyone has or could, but if it fulfill the law, shall judge thee, who by the letter and circumcision does transgress the law. And you know, we're right back to Romans 2:16. God judges the secrets of men. God's going to judge the secrets of men. He's not going to be looking at the externals. He's going to be looking at the internals. He's going to be looking at the hidden things of men. Verse 28, for he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew which is one inwardly, that of the heart, and circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit and not in the letter, whose praise is not of God, but is not of men, but of God. And so he's bringing it right back to that thing that we've been talking about in all of Romans 2, that heart issue, the hidden things issue. It's not going to, the external circumcision is what matters. It matters the condition of the heart. Remember in the first half of Romans 1, remember what we said? Inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are, he thinks he'll be able to stand before God based on his own works. And Paul destroys that. He's not going to be looking at the works. He's going to be looking at the heart. He's going to look at the hidden things. Where were they produced? What's the condition of the heart? And if that heart is hard and unrepentant, he's going to know it came out of a contaminated factory. And when we get to the end here, you see he's doing the same thing with the Jew, verse 28. Verse 29, but he is a Jew which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart. He's not going to look at works. He's going to look at where those works came from. He's just, you know, the circumcision. Why does Paul bring up circumcision here? What is it? It's a work of the law. And just as the inexcusable old man, whosoever you are, wasn't going to be able to present his external works to God, because God's going to look at where they came from, same way with the Jew. Even if they're works of the law, external works of the law, which circumcision epitomizes for the Jew, he's not going to look at that. He's going to look at the condition of the heart. And that's where the problem comes in, the heart. It's all a heart issue. Now let's go back and look, and I call this a little journey of the heart. Let's flip back a page to Romans 1, verse 21, let's go on a journey of what's happened to the heart as we've gone through this passage. Look at Romans 1:21. Because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God. Notice, this is that glory concept coming in again. What God is doing through Paul is primarily, foremostly, is manifesting his glory. And we get in the last half where they have thrown away God's glory. They've thrown away God's truth, ever they've thrown away God's glory. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. All right, so here's the starting point. Foolish and darkened hearts. That's what we were all born with. A foolish and darkened heart. That's our state and that's our grand entrance into the world. Foolish and darkened heart. But what happens when that foolish and darkened heart is confronted by the truth of God? The truth of God for them. Look over at chapter 2. What happens when the truth of God confronts them and they reject it? They, as the terminology of Romans 2:4, they despise it. They reject it in unbelief. They throw it away. They think it doesn't have value to them. They think it doesn't apply to them. Look at verse 5 in chapter 2. But after thy hardness and impenitent heart treasureth up wrath unto the day of wrath, unto the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. Now look what's happened to this heart. This heart that was foolish and darkened has come face to face with God's truth for today. What God is doing through the apostleship of Paul, the apostleship message ministry of Paul, he's taken that, he's rejected it, he's cast it away as worthless, doesn't want it around, and that foolish and darkened heart turns into a hardened and unrepentant heart. After the truth of God is confronted and it's been rejected, it becomes hardened and unrepentant. And for the Jew, look down at verse 29 now, for the Jew, but he is a Jew which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart. You see, for the Jew, that continues to extend into uncircumcision of the heart. We've gone through a foolish and darkened heart who rebels against God, continues to rebel against God's truth for today, and that turns that heart into a hardened and unrepentant heart. And when that occurs to a Jew, they have the additional thing of that being an uncircumcised heart. See, it's all a heart problem. There's a heart problem in humanity. At the end of verse 29, in the spirit and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God, which implies, or the reverse, that's true of these Jews. Their praise was of men. They cared more about what men thought than what God was doing today. And that brings us to the end of that chapter. And I actually, looking at the time, I'm not going to have time for this, but I actually was going to go in and do an even bigger journey of the heart, but I think I'm going to pass that up. You can do it for your own Bible study, and I call that the heart issue. And I'm going to, the notes are over there if someone wants to do it. Now I've got, and that would be a great study on your own. I think if I stay any longer in Romans 2, there might be a rebellion among the crew. So I'm going on to Romans 3, but just to show you how I haven't even touched the surface of Romans 2. I hope I've covered some of the important things. A, what I was going to talk about today, I'm not going to get to, so you can do your own study in the heart journey, and you go all the way back to Deuteronomy 6, where they're commanded to respond to God out of the heart. And you can follow that journey. The notes are over there if you want to use that. But here are some other topics I was going to talk about in Romans 2. But as I said, I think there'd be rebellion if I stayed any longer in Romans 2. So here's some other things. I was going to talk about the things that differ in Romans 2. Let's look at verse 18. Romans 2, verse 18. And knowest his will and approve the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law. Here the Jews thought they were able to, in today's economy, they were able to know the things that differ, know the things that are more excellent, know the things that count, know how to be a guide and teacher and all that, but it only led them to sin and breaking the law. And this is the only thing I'll look at with this. Look over at Philippians 1, Let's just flip. You keep your finger here. We're going to come right back. But look at Philippians 1, and let's see. Paul only uses this phrase one more time. Things that differ are the things that are more excellent. Look at Philippians 1:10. He's talking to the Philippians now, who are true grace believers, true people who have appreciated Paul's distinct apostleship and are supporting it and proclaiming it. Verse 10, that ye may approve the things that differ, the things that are more excellent. See, now he's showing the real way today we approve the things that are more excellent. And what's the result when we do that? That ye may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ. See, what Paul is, God is accomplishing now through the apostleship of Paul is the only way to know the things that are more excellent for us today and the things that will keep us sincere and without offense till the day of Christ. So I was going to do a little series on that. Psalm 50 and 51. If you want to do an amazing study, go to Psalm. We didn't even touch on 50. We talked about 51 in the Davidic covenant. Psalm 50, you're going to go find there that about the, and if you go back to Romans 2, you're going to find there that about the first verses 17 through 23 or so are right out of Psalm 50, where he talks about the wrong way to be a teacher and an instructor, and the wrong way to do that. And he talks there specifically about the people who teach thou shalt not commit adultery, and yet they commit adultery. And he talks about that. Look at Psalm 50, and then Psalm 51 gives an example of David as the right way to be a teacher. And it's not until the last half of Psalm 51 that you learn the right way to be a teacher, because first David had to learn how to deal with sin. And that's what he brings up in the first half. So that was another thing I was going to talk about. Oops. And the next thing is the law. This in this chapter is the first instance of that very important topic, the law. I think I'm going to put that off either till chapter 3 or chapter 4. And then lastly, I was going to go off like I did on David on a little series on Abraham and cover circumcision and all that. But I think after spending as much time on David we did, we're going to skip Abraham. We'll pick him up again in Romans 4. So those are some of the things I didn't get to. So if you think I talked a lot about Romans 2, just think it could have been worse. All right, now I want to set us up for next week. This is just in conclusion. And I want to show a structure that we can all keep in our mind and show how beautiful and harmonious the first three chapters of Romans is, so that when we start getting into Romans 3, we can really appreciate what God is doing there. So these are things that should be very familiar to you. The first half we've already covered. Romans 1, the first half of Romans 1 is Paul's distinct apostleship and the righteousness of God. That's what's brought. It begins with the power of the resurrection, and it ends with the power of salvation and the righteousness of God. Then, in the last half of Romans 1, we had the pattern of fallen humanity, especially the Gentiles, in rejecting God's glory revealed in creation. So just keep that in mind, these two things, how they begin, and we're going to see something line up here. Then as we got into Romans 2, the first half of Romans 2, we get the inexcusable old man whosoever you are, and he points out that everybody needs what God is dispensing through the apostleship of Paul. It applies to everybody, and there's no other way of being escaping God's judgment. There's no other way to respond to the time when God is being long-suffering. And now, the next thing is the absolutely pivotal, I think, verse in this whole section. Romans 2:16, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ according to Paul's gospel. That is like the hinge verse in the first three chapters, in my opinion, anyway. That is the hinge. That's what everything turns on. And now watch what happens as we start to go back. We already know the first half of Romans 2 is all need the riches of God and the riches that God is dispensing through Paul. And we already know, we talked about it this morning, that the last half of Romans 2 brings out that Jews also are no exception. They need the riches God is dispensing through Paul. Then, as you get into the first half of Romans 3, He's going to explain the pattern of fall. He's going to line up with the last half of chapter 2, and he's going to show the pattern of fallen humanity, especially the Jews, in rejecting God's revealed, what the glory God revealed in Paul's apostleship. And we get that line, and you're going to believe, if you don't recognize it right now, you will when we get into the first half of Romans 3, because it lines up in so many ways with the last half of Romans 1. And then finally, when we get to Romans 3:21 to the end of the chapter, the last half of Romans 3, we're back to Paul's distinctive apostleship and the righteousness of God. And that is what that whole this whole section hinges on and is a pattern to and is bringing us around to. And all of this is not, as most teachers say, to make known our salvation. This section is there primarily. I'm not saying it doesn't make known our salvation. It does. But the primary reason it's here, and I'll end on this, is to make known the glory of God. He's going to explain how God can maintain his glory while justifying sinners. And in there we come too. So we'll go ahead and pick it up there next week.